welcome to this 18th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 9th chapter, titled The Cosmos. Chapter 9, The Cosmos. If You Could Hie to Kolob, a hymn written by W.W. Phelps, who lived 1792 to 1872. If you could hie to Kolob in the twinkling of an eye, and then continue onward with that same speed to fly, do you think that you could ever, through all eternity, find out the generation where gods began to be? Or see the grand beginning where space did not extend, or view the last creation where gods and matter end? Methinks the spirit whispers, no man has found pure space, nor seen the outside curtains where nothing has a place. The works of God continue, and worlds and lives abound. Improvement and progression have one eternal round. There is no end to matter. There is no end to space. There is no end to spirit. There is no end to race. There is no end to virtue. There is no end to might. There is no end to wisdom. There is no end to light. There is no end to union. There is no end to youth. There is no end to priesthood. There is no end to truth. There is no end to glory. There is no end to love. There is no end to being. There is no death above. There is no end to glory. There is no end to love. There is no end to being. There is no death above. Now, Kolob, in the lore of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is a planet that is close to the throne of God. W.W. Phelps was a hymn writer in the early LDS Church and a staunch friend of Joseph Smith. We think the cosmos is huge. Our minds must be just as large to take it all in. The expansion of our mind is one of our prime works here on this planet. Infinite cosmos equals infinite mind. The title of this book is Becoming Human in the Cosmos. Most of what I've written so far deals with the human part. And now, let's look at the cosmos. I promised earlier to deal with my conflicts between reincarnation and a theology that says we're here only once. Three books in my library, and from which I've quoted a few times in the preceding chapters, base their insights on past life regression hypnosis. They are Memories of God and Creation by Shakuntala Modi, and Journey of Souls and Destiny of Souls by Michael Newton. I've also mentioned being a reader of Stephen Gould, America's evolutionist, and have interwoven evolution freely in this discussion. I'm on record as saying God is just science we don't yet know, coupled with an overwhelming love for his children. Now I'm going to try and bring all three of these concepts together, evolution, creation, and reincarnation. In doing so, I'll probably displease proponents of each individual study, but that was my purpose, as stated in the introduction, to bring together all parts of this elephant we call human life. All I can say to mollify any one advocate of any one of these fields is that what I'm about to write or speak is only my current speculation on these issues, not a hard belief nor a theological assertion. This is just speculation, people. Just lying on my back in the grass, gazing into the heavens and saying, maybe this is how it all comes together. This isn't a hill I want to die on, just a hill I want to climb to sample the view. I think it works like this. God has many roads leading to one basic plan for his children, and depending on their spiritual maturity and needs, they can be placed on whatever road will reliably take them there. So why doesn't God tell us? Perhaps he did. Oriental religions, which bring the idea of reincarnation to Western thought, are the gift of the East to humanity. All religions have something to contribute. The first road is evolution coupled with reincarnation. The second is special creation, which is the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve and their descendants. Now, why would God have multiple plans? Well, why does a university have four or more classes of students, freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors, plus post-grads? At any university, we can see these four classes freely mixed on the campus. The undergraduates will be coming back the next year to complete their education. Think reincarnation. The seniors are there for the last time, or for our purposes, just that one year. Think those who at death are advanced to the point where they needn't fool with the mortal experience anymore, or the traditional Christian concept of one earth life per person. They're all there mixed together, because this is the place of education, and each of their needs are met by being in this place, albeit in different classes with different professors. Here's how, maybe, it works. God sets up a universe via a Big Bang, allowing natural laws to begin the formation of hydrogen gas, clouds, then suns, then the explosion of suns to bring about the heavier elements, then galaxies, solar systems, and habitable planets. From there, evolution is introduced, and the lower life forms get their chance to work out their lives. Evolution continues until millions of years have passed and the first hominids evolve, but their bodies aren't quite up to the standards that God would label in his image. We can't really picture God looking like a Neanderthal. But so what? As we mentioned earlier, each life form chooses where it will get off the bus, as it were, to stop at the point where it feels is progress enough. We've chosen to ride that bus to the end of the line. Others opted out. That's their choice and is no excuse for us to be judgmental. This continues until a group of spirits is ready to be created directly in the image of God, or at least be the pure offspring of those parents who are so created. At this point, there are two races: those descended from evolution, or daughters of men, and those created directly by God, descendants of Adam and Eve, coexisting on the earth about 6,000 years ago, or sons of God, as referred to in Genesis chapter 6, verse 2. DNA research on our matriarchal lines has been done, and our ancestry has been traced back to an Eve from the plains of Africa. Quote, "About 200,000 years ago, a woman existed whose mitochondrial DNA was the source of the mitochondrial DNA in every person alive today. That is, all of us are her descendants." Smithsonian Magazine, July 2008, page 60. Could this Eve be the mother of the race of the daughters of men that Genesis refers to? I've no way of saying positively, but the wording in Genesis and the DNA studies do interest me. Since it sounds sexist to refer to the superior or God-created race as masculine, sons of God, and the inferior or evolved race as feminine, or daughters of men, we must be careful to note that is simply the wording of the scriptures, and it doesn't imply a female inferiority to the male. That was dealt with in the previous chapter. This Eve was a modern human, according to anthropologists, so it's not like the sons of God were hooking up with Neanderthal girls, who, if I remember back to my teenage years, looked hot in their saber-toothed catskin skirts. But that's another story. Stephen Gould, quoted many times in these pages, addresses the concept of a human existence prior to and parallel with that of Adam in his book, I Have Landed, pages 134-5. Let me skip through it. Quote, the claim that humans existed before Adam and that the man described in the first chapter of Genesis only denotes God's later creation of the Jews and other allied peoples must have occurred to anyone who ever read the Bible with a critical eye. Several passages in Genesis, if taken at face value, seem to imply the existence of pre-Adamites. He gives as evidence, since no sisters to Cain are mentioned, whom did Cain marry? God later curses Cain to be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth for killing his brother Abel, and places a mark on Cain after Cain begs for mitigation by pleading, "Everyone that findeth me shall slay me." So God relents and places the famous mark upon him. Therefore, whosoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. But why did Cain need such a fancy ID if no one else, except perhaps a few unnamed siblings, then inhabited the earth? Gould also questions Genesis 6, as we have, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men and took them wives. Now, are the sons members of Adam's line and the daughters of some other stock, or vice versa? In either case, the comment seems to designate two distinct lineages, one perhaps pre-Adamic. End quote. The idea of humans on earth before Adam doesn't automatically deny the existence of God and creation. Hugh Nibley writes, quote, do not begrudge existence to creatures that looked like men long, long ago, nor deny them a place in God's affection or even a right to exaltation, for our scriptures allow them such. Nor am I overly concerned as to just when they might have lived, for their world is not our world. God assigned them their proper times and functions, as he has given me mine. It is Adam as my own parent who concerns me. End quote. Old Testament and Related Studies, page 82, previously cited. Thus, the ideas of evolution and biblical creation can coexist in the minds of all but the most dogmatically fundamentalistic on both sides of the issue. I think of the earth in terms of an apartment complex. We have moved in, but there are other tenants who have been in the apartment building for months and years before us, and the very apartment we've moved into was previously inhabited. Hugh Nibley writes thus, eloquent witness, previously quoted, we overlook the manifest truth that the planet was meant for multiple use. To take fullest advantage of its limited space and resources, discrete periods of time have been set apart for the accommodation of different species. Thus, one now celebrated population used the planet for millions of years, dinosaurs, without in any way interfering or competing with us. Then they were abruptly moved out, and they are free to do it without our knowledge or permission. Their assigned time on Earth is their own. Must I deny their existence simply because I was not told about them? This could well apply to proto-humans such as Neanderthals, Cro-Magnon, Australopithecine, and others. There is a huge megalithic complex at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which dates from about 11,000 years ago. Who were they? What did they worship that required such a large structure? The Aborigines of Australia are believed to have been there for 40,000 years, and they have rock paintings of cosmic, supernatural, and festive objects. What were they worshiping? Reference Nibley, One Eternal Round, pages 117 and 128. Previously cited. Many people on both sides of the evolution-creation issue need to open their minds to some incredible possibilities. Then it was our turn. God commanded Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Genesis 1:28. The verb replenish means to restock or refill. One can't replenish something that has never had something in it to begin with that was somehow depleted. This implies at least some kind of tenant in the apartment that Adam and Eve moved into that had, by some means, left that apartment vacant. So what? It is our time and turn now. Let us live and develop our lives according to God's plans for us, and not leave a mess that will cause us to forfeit our cleaning deposit. Consider my wife doing laundry. She tosses in the clothes, the soap, closes the lid, and pushes the button on the machine. Then she puts her feet up and watches TV until the buzzer goes off. Now, who or what just did the wash? The machine? But it took someone to put in the clothes, soap, and hit the right switches. Okay, so my wife did the laundry. But she was kicking back watching TV while the machine went through its cycles. Okay, so the machine did it then. The debate between God and evolution is the same. To maintain peace around my house, I say my wife did the laundry. The machine's feelings won't be hurt. To maintain peace in the cosmos, I suggest the same. God created all we see by means of natural law and many laws we don't yet know but are discovering. For my money, evolution studies are just an exercise in reverse engineering. Same could be said for the Big Bang. Note, as we page through the scriptures, an emphasis that gradually diminishes regarding mixing of the two races, the children of God and the children of men. From the Book of Enoch, page 5, quote, "And it came to pass, when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of the heavens, or children of Adam, saw and lusted after them, and said to one another, Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and beget us children." This mixes things up a bit. It uses the phrase children of men, but the idea of a race of earth humans combining with a race of heavenly humans is still there, and could still imply an illicit mix between children of evolution and children of direct creation. Genesis chapter 6, verse 2 says much the same thing, though not with so much detail. Before we go further, let me absolutely warn against this being interpreted as a racial theory. Is one a son of God? A child of men? There simply is no way to tell. Skin color won't do. Genetic testing would tell us nothing. It has been at least 6,000 years since these events, and as we see from current genealogical and biological DNA studies, the human race has been pretty well mingled. Even Jews, who at one time had a good claim on being a chosen race, have had their bloodlines well mixed with all the nations of man. I make no claim myself for special lineage, and I'm writing this. I'm sure I have as much blood of the children of men in me as anyone. One thing the human race does not need is another reason to be self-righteous and vaunt themselves above their fellow man. Look at all the harm racist theories based on social Darwinism did at the turn of the century and on into World War II, an application of Darwin's theories that he never intended. So let me be on record as stating flatly that I'm not writing this to foment racial theories. Anyone who knows me knows I don't give a damn for political correctness, but I do want the record clear on this issue. The regrettable human tendency to divide and be conquered is one of our major weaknesses. At this point in history, we're all in this together. We all have the same ancestry of sons of God, daughters of men, and none of us has any cause to think we're better than others by virtue of a descent that can only be imagined and never proved. But as to mixing races, in Genesis and in the Book of Enoch, this caused great harm. The offspring of these unions turned out to be giants and raised a lot of trouble. Quote, "And the women have borne giants, and the whole earth has thereby been filled with blood and unrighteousness." Page 7, Book of Enoch, previously cited. As to literal giants, I don't think they mean the fee-fi-fo-fum type. Just big, strong, aggressive, troublemaking people, such as Goliath, who had his duel with David. Though this race is largely wiped out through the flood of Noah, I'm sure their seed continued and is spread throughout the whole of the planet today. The whole world wasn't flooded, as there is no geological evidence for it, just the vicinity of Noah and those evildoers in his immediate neighborhood. Noah and his three children couldn't have repopulated the entire earth. If this is the way it was, and I'm not at all sure it is, we can see how evolution and creation can coexist. As to keeping the races separate, in the beginning it was considered an evil for the sons of God to procreate with the daughters of men. Staying in Genesis, we note the emphasis placed on Abraham's posterity, Isaac and Jacob, and the importance of these boys getting wives not of the local non-Abrahamic population, but from relatives. Genesis 24:3 and 27:46. This continues through Solomon, who was turned away from God by marrying non-Israelite wives. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 4. By the time the New Testament comes around, Paul, who brought all races into the Christian church, is only concerned that members not marry unbelievers, and race isn't even mentioned. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. The point is, by that time, races were pretty well mixed, and the only thing that mattered was whether or not one shared the same faith. What I am conjecturing is that this shows two of God's plans for the progress of his children. Plan number one is coming to earth as a descendant of Adam and Eve, having one mortal experience, then going on to perfection in the eternities to whatever level we can rise, the traditional Judeo-Christian take. This could also include those who, through reincarnation, had gained education and experience to the point where all they needed was one more shot at mortality to put a polish on their development, and at death, go on into the family business, Salvation Incorporated. Plan two is to reincarnate as often and as much as it takes to begin to learn the lessons we need to advance to plan one, or again with our college metaphor, to come into the senior class and graduate. There are many roads to our ultimate realization of our human spirit, just as long as we eventually get there. That's all that matters. All plans would have the same goal, becoming like Christ and being one with God. There may well be as many plans as there are children of God. Also, this is no contradiction. All are the same. All are different. I think this dualist concept is a fundamental principle of the Gospels. In My Descent into Death, previously cited, Howard Storm illustrates, quote, "Anything good is possible on this journey to God. The universe is full of worlds, many far superior to the one we left. Some people have left behind loved ones that need their protection and guidance. They can live as guardian angels for a while as part of their spiritual development. Some apprentice themselves to great angels to learn lessons they missed in this life. Anything good is possible. The universe and heaven are full of life experiences to teach us about God. The universe is more varied and full of life than we can imagine. All of this richness and experience can be a growing experience to becoming Christ-like, to be united with God." Page 56. He says twice, "Anything good is possible." I think that's worth repeating for the expansion of our minds and souls to bring us out of narrow, knee-jerk exclusivity. Anything good is possible. Let's look at plan two, reincarnation, for a bit, and see what's going on. As best as I can understand it, these premortal memories are brought up through some kind of hypnotic therapy. Dr. Michael Newton, author of Journey of Souls and Destiny of Souls, describes the mind and the hypnotic regression process thus, quote, "Visualize the mind as having three concentric circles. The first outer layer is represented by the conscious mind, which is our critical, analytic reasoning source. The second layer is the subconscious, where we initially go in hypnosis to tap into the storage area for all the memories that ever happened to us in this life and former lives. The third, the innermost core, is what we are now calling the superconscious mind. This level exposes the highest center of self, where we are an expression of a higher power. Journey of Souls, page 3. One of the phenomena that makes these concepts show up on my radar is the consistency of the reported experiences, like near-death experiences. Newton reports, quote, once subjects were regressed back into their soul state, they all displayed a remarkable consistency in responding to questions about the spirit world. People even used the same words and graphic descriptions in colloquial language when discussing their lives as souls. Page 5. In fact, there are similarities with the near-death experience. Quote, both find themselves floating around their bodies in a strange way, trying to touch solid objects which dematerialize in front of them. Both kinds of reporters say they are frustrated in their attempts to talk to living people who don't respond. Both state they feel a pulling sensation away from the place where they are and experience relaxation and curiosity rather than fear. There's also a lighted tunnel effect reported. Page 9. Newton theorizes in Journey of Souls, previously cited, page 69, about the conflict of spirits accustomed to heavenly realms and their jarring disconnect upon arrival on Earth to inhabit evolved bodies. Quote, souls are created in a positive matrix of such love and wisdom that when a soul starts to come to a planet like Earth and join the physical beings who have evolved from a primitive state, the violence is a shock. Humans have the raw, negative emotions of anger and hate as an outgrowth of their fear and pain connected with survival going back to the Stone Age. Note, by the way, that souls are created in a matrix of love and wisdom. God the Father is love. Heavenly Mother, as described earlier, is wisdom. Coincidence? Well, I'll just run it up the flagpole and see who salutes. In an earlier chapter, I compared the premortal spirit to software and the human body it inhabits, the mind in particular, to a computer. The software comes programmed with love, light, and gentleness. The computer is set to run automatically programs such as survival, fight or flight, and a total self-centeredness. This conflict is purposeful. Will we give in to the fear of the animal instincts programmed into our evolved bodies, or will we master them to become truly gentle, loving, and Christ-like? Betty Eady points out that she learned the opposite of love isn't hate, but rather fear. We have the premortal existence legacy of love, and our bodies, via our evolved brains, have the survival instinct of fear. Can we overcome that? And look how much of the advertising industry bases their campaigns and motivations on fear. Fear of body odor, rejection, losing money, not being in style. I stated at the beginning of this chapter that I'd try to bring creationism, evolution, and reincarnation together. Betty Eady, previously cited, mentions our part in the creation of this earth. Quote, all people as spirits in the premortal world took part in the creation of the earth. We were thrilled to be part of it. Each spirit who was to come to Earth assisted in planning the conditions on Earth, including the laws of mortality, which would govern us. These included the laws of physics, as we know them, the limitations of our bodies and spiritual powers that we would be able to access. We assisted God in the development of plants and animals that would be here. Embraced by the Light, page 47. It seems from Newton's hypnotic regression studies that we, as children of God, are trained in the creation process as part of our growth and education. He interviews one client under hypnosis and gets these responses, previously cited, pages 186 through 7. I'll just skip, quote, through the two pages. Newton is asking the questions. His patient is responding, quote, where do you start? With embryos. we give instructions to organisms within the surrounding conditions. Then, when souls start to create forms of life, they begin with microorganisms. Small cells, yes, and this is very difficult to learn. The cells of life, our energy, cannot become proficient unless we can direct it to alter molecules. I would pause to note here that it is a tentative evolutionary theory that changes come about by cosmic ray alteration of DNA molecules. Is this what Newton's patient is referring to? Can't say for sure. He continues, a soul who becomes proficient with actually creating life must be able to split cells and give DNA instructions, and you do this by sending particles of energy into protoplasm. The patient responds, we must learn to do this, yes, coordinating it with a sun's energy. It turns out each sun has different energy patterns for each world, and as the sun is the source of energy, hence life for each planet, then the evolving life must be created to be receptive to the particular sun of the particular planet. Newton, previously cited, asks why they'd interfere with the natural processes of evolution to the sun, and the patient responds, it is not interference. We examine new structures, mutations, to watch and see what is workable. We arrange substances for their most effective use with different suns. As to the question of time, how can souls watch and influence biological properties of growth evolving over millions of years on a primordial world? Time is not in Earth years for us. We use it to suit our experiments. We'll get into the relativity of time as this chapter unwinds. Biologists say there is only a 2% difference in the DNA between humans and the higher apes. Suppose the DNA in the precursor species of apes and humans is deliberately tweaked to begin a direction that will, over several generations, result in a Homo sapiens. Not right away, of course. A change in all 2% of the DNA at once would be too drastic. The infant couldn't survive in the wild and would probably be killed by the group, as most animals have a tendency to kill malformed infants, perhaps for the better good of the species. But for discussion's sake, let's say that in each generation, that 0.1% of the DNA is deliberately tweaked so a trend towards Homo sapiens is established. And of course, all DNA is linked. You can't just tweak one molecule of it and wind up with a hairless chimp. There are a host of other support structures that also have to be altered for the one to work. In 200 generations, this is probably way too few, the human family would have evolved from the ape precursor line by intelligent guidance, as Newton and Betty Eady relate above. How long do apes live, or what constitutes a generation with them? Probably no more than 10 to 15 years. So, in 3,000 years, humans could evolve from this ancient ancestor, assuming a deliberate directing of the manipulation of the DNA. Okay, I agree, way too short a time, but this is only for illustration's sake. Now, that's just 3,000 years. Consider the 3 billion years that life has been evolving on Earth from the single-celled bacteria. That would give these life creation spirits, all of us in one way or another, I believe, 1 million times as much time to work with these life forms to create all the species that inhabit this world. Continuously building on our few and far between successes over time, which is relative here, we now see the world as it is today with its amazing variety of life, all successfully adapted to their ecological niches and living in peace and cooperation until man comes along and fools with them, but that's another story. Experimental indeed. Evolutionists will tell you that the vast majority of life forms that have inhabited this planet have become extinct. In Wonderful Life, page 47, Stephen Gould, in this great study of the fossil bonanza of the Burgess Shale in Canada, reports that fully 90% of the life forms found there are now extinct. Quote, the sweep of anatomical variety reached a maximum right after the initial diversification of multicellular animals. The later history of life proceeded by elimination, not expansion. The current Earth may hold more species than ever before, but most are iterations upon a few basic anatomical designs. For instance, there are over 1 million beetle types, but they're all based on a similar ground plan, just as there are hundreds of breeds of dogs. As mentioned above, the creating souls watch and see what is workable, then go from there using off-the-shelf parts, as it were. Why reinvent the wheel for every new life form? As summarized in Equations of Eternity by David Darling, previously cited, page 8, quote, as always, evolution has been conservative, economical, building upon what is proven to be sound, rather than redesigning the whole from scratch. Most scientists will tell you that the great majority of their experiments yield a null result. In other words, their idea didn't work out. It apparently is the same with the creation of life. Gould refers to this phenomenon as a kind of reverse decimation. Decimation means taking one-tenth of a population and killing it. Evolution, it seems, takes nine-tenths. Most die and few are chosen. A 90% chance of death would be a good estimate for major Burgess lineages. Previously cited with Stephen Gould. And thus we conclude this 18th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Cosmos Continued, and we'll deal with the 9th chapter, part 2. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com. That's hazelleproductions.com. And thank you.